Thanks, Bruce. First of all, I'd like to apologise for the slight delay in getting started this morning. There's a bit of irony about that because last night while we were out on the town, I joked that we can't start the talk without me since I was the first speaker. But this morning, the reality was that my credit card wouldn't be accepted by the hotel. So there was a phone call to the UK and it was all sorted out. So that's why I'm So, first of all, I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me and giving the chance to talk to everybody. It's definitely been a very stimulating meeting. And I'm going to actually have to leave today. I also would definitely have stayed for the whole thing, but I have no choice but got that much. So I'm sure the rest of it will be okay. So one of the crucial questions that I always like to sort of present with people is, because I've been asked about four times, where is Dundee anyway? So, Dundee is on the east coast of Scotland. Okay, so Scotland's kind of the upper half of the thing that's part of the UK, which is normally called England. So that upper half is Scotland. And Edinburgh's also on the east coast. Aberdeen's here and Aberdeen's here and Dundee's here. So it's kind of the fourth largest city. So it's not that big.
Why is it green?
Because it's very green there. Anyway, it also gives me an excuse to show this really nice shot of we should dim the lights at the front. Of the Tay Bridge, which was the longest rail bridge in Europe for a while. And that's sort of got the Tay River runs right through the middle of Dundee. Anyway, so a little bit of background because there was some discussion or some, I think Howard was telling people what I actually did, so I thought I might as well tell you what I did instead. So, right at, this doesn't actually work, no, it does. So with Brian Sleeman right in 1907, I did my PhD with him, that was on looking at nematode movement. And so this represents a little nematode which started here migrating through soil towards a plant root which was somewhere up here. So this is where I developed this hybrid technique where you have a sort of discrete, in this case it was a discrete nematode, a worm, migrating through a sort of continuum chemical fields. I then developed that further with Mark Chapman in Bath initially and applied it towards angiogenesis, which some of you are probably familiar with. And so we initially did that in 2D, and then we took that to 3D, and then subsequently I then applied the same technique but looking at tumour invasion, initially at a continuum scale, where this is looking at a blob of tissue, and then subsequently my most recent work, which is kind of on my own, is where I've looked at that kind of more detailed cellular properties at the discrete level. So today I'm going to give a bit of a summary, briefly touch on the angiogenesis work, because really Stephen McDougall, who spoke earlier in the week, has kind of carried that work forward. We collaborate together, but he's the main guy that's kind of leading that now. And I'm going to focus really on the invasion. So it's just a bit of both. Okay, so I'm sure all of you are familiar with, you know, the main phases of tumour growth, but it's always nice to put a kind of summary slide up here just to sort of see where it all sits. And Stephen kind of used a similar slide. In fact, he got it from me. So here we have, this is a nice, 3D micrograph passing through a spheroid, and you see there's a kind of central region which is hollow, and so that's the kind of dead central region. And so normally what happens is these spheroids will grow up to a maximum of roughly 2 millimetres, and then because of all the necrosis and they just can't grow any further, then the whole process of angiogenesis is initiated by these necrotic cells. Will actually quiescent cells secreting angiogenic factors into the surrounding tissue, which capture a neighbouring blood vessel, and then endothelial cells within that blood vessel will then degrade it and migrate towards the. So this is an example of an experiment where they've placed a small tumour in the cornea of the mouse, and your main vessel running along here, and the response clearly seen. And once you have an angiogenic network, of course, the tumour can grow much larger and ultimately can invade. And of course, if you've also got that network, the cells can break away and metastasize.
Can you just clarify that comment? So it's hollow.
Well, it's hollow in the sense that it's probably debris, from dead cells.
But there isn't density of materials, fluid.
There's some sort of fluid mixture in there. It's not like air in there.
No, not air, but just fluid, water. Fluid.
Sure.
But there is an actual hollow.
Well, you can see that, yeah, there is definitely like a kind of an empty region in some sense that there's no living cells in it.
But it's actually very dense, full of materials.
Sure, sure. It's not empty, but it's not getting living cells. That's the crucial thing. Okay, so in some sense you can see here, it's clear, and we're all here because of that, is that angiogenesis links these two phases. So clearly if we can, you know, do something about angiogenesis, stop it, inhibit it, then we might be able to stop it going from here to here. Okay, so from 2 millimeters to 10 centimeters. So I'm going to talk about a bit about angiogenesis and a bit about invasion. So this is a nice schematic diagram that one of Mark's PhD students drew. And it kind of shows the whole life cycle. And so initially this is like the, you know, the tumour, if you imagine, was smaller. It secretes those angiogenic factors, those endothelial cells that are lining the vessel, break down the basal lamina, start to migrate towards the tumour, and as they do so, they're forming sort of little vessels of their own. Blood will start to flow in those vessels, they'll start to branch, and eventually they connect and make a proper, you know, microvasculature for the tumour. And in some sense, it's maybe a bit idealised, because normally tumour vasculature is a bit of a mess, and this makes it look very nice. But it gives you the idea. Okay, so to summarise, in some sense, you can look at this as an idealised model of an endothelial cell in response to an angiogenic, when it's been triggered to produce an angiogenic network. So what I assume, and there is some experimental evidence for aspects of this, which is that the endothelial cells respond chemotactically to angiogenic factor. The angiogenic factor is produced by the tumour. And now that's a really kind of general term, because there's many angiogenic factors. There's just a big mix of growth factors that the tumour's sending out. And so they'll migrate up gradients of that, so towards the highest concentration, which is, of course, the tumour source. They respond haptotactically to the ECM. So, and what, as somebody asked earlier, what do you mean by haptotaxis? Mathematically, it's very similar, but it really means something different. So the way to think about haptotaxis is that it's a gradient of adhesion in terms of cell to matrix adhesion. So if the the higher density of, say, fibronectin or collagen, then the cells find it easier to pull themselves along, so they can climb easier in those higher densities. So that's haptotaxis. And so then we're going to assume that the endothelial cells produce some matrix-degrading enzymes. Those enzymes will degrade the tissue, and we know that the endothelial cells produce their own kind of matrix molecules. And there'll be some binding of angiogenic factor by the endothelial cells.
Could it be that if you have a very high concentration of ligands, that your cell motility is going down again?
Yeah, so there's probably some sort of dose response type thing. You know, there'll be, once it gets too high, then it's just like kind of trying to climb into a brick wall in some sense, you're right, or the receptor just becomes so saturated. And probably the same is true for chemotaxis as well. Okay, so here's the model. I'm going to present initially the continuum model, because as the title says, from continua to individual, to continue to discrete cells. And so I'm sure you've seen this equation before. We're assuming endothelial cells migrate randomly. They move via chemotaxis. So C, that's going to be the angiogenic factor, and F is the matrix. And so you see mathematically those two forms are very, very similar. There's no proliferation in this model, because I do that all at the discrete level. And this is just going to be looking at some very initial simulations of the continuum. So then the assumption here is that the angiogenic factor is bound by the endothelial cells as they migrate through it, and that was a sort of point of contention in Stephen McDougall's talk. And so one of the things I just wanted to mention about this was that it's clear that there's a giant gradient with the tumour cells, kind of idealised in one dimension. So if this is the tumour and this is your parent vessel, the tumour sending out this chemical gradient, then you're going to have something that's like that. You know, it's very high here. So if the endothelial cells start to migrate out and they can somehow, you know, locally consume a small amount of that or bind a little bit of that, it's not going to make any difference in terms of the direction of migration. Because essentially the worst that they can do would be to do a little kind of bump in that, which chemotactically would mean the same thing, and you go towards the tumour. So that's kind of the point I was trying to make with regards to it's not so crucial. But you know, it's maybe valid to say that if the angiogenic factor is being produced by the tumour, it's diffusing quickly, then this might not have such a big impact. But there was several discussions here about the fact that these antigenic factors are probably bound within the tissue, in which case that would have a small impact.
Yeah. I think we all believe that endothelial cell proliferation is a major response.
Sure.
Why
and
don't you model that?
I do model that, but I just don't think it's correct to model it at a continuum level. And I'll explain why in a minute. So then the next is the matrix degrading, not the matrix macromolecule, which we see is produced by the endothelial cells and is degraded by the matrix degrading enzyme, which is the last equation, which we're assuming has some very small diffusion coefficient, some natural decay, and is produced by the endothelial cells. Now, this is meant to represent tip cell density, okay? So this is not the complete network. It's only the cells that are at the leading edge, okay? So that's one of the reasons why we don't proliferate them, is because we're assuming they're tip cells. But also, if I was to put proliferation in there, the standard proliferation term is like logistic growth or some sort of, you know, homogenizing growth, which assumes all cells will proliferate at the same time with the same proliferation rate, which is completely untrue for angiogenesis, as we all know. So that's why I don't put proliferation in the continuum model.
Yeah.
But aren't your variables here functions of space as well as time?
They are.
Well, then why don't you, I don't quite understand then.
So, well, you know, if you put logistic growth in there,
yeah,
how are you going to make it specific? Are you going to have some sort of spatial constraint that says if you're a certain distance behind the tip, you proliferate? Is that what you mean?
Well, you're still talking about averages over.
Sure, sure. Okay, well, we can maybe discuss that once
okay.
I've shown some simulation.
I have another question about the rate of change of tap. Actually, it seems to me that you assume that the half-life of TAP is pretty long. Do you think it's realistic? Or?
Well, no, I'm not actually assuming that. What I'm assuming is that the tumour is continually producing angiogenic factor, which is diffusing, and the half-life, you know, so there's a consumption or a degradation of the TAP, and you can show mathematically with the diffusion, decay, and sort of on this boundary, if you said there was, it got set to zero on the boundary, or it got consumed at the boundary, then mathematically with that you can solve that equation and get that profile. In fact, Mark Chaplin did that in like 92 or something.
Yeah, but the equation does not show it shows just the decay.
Sure, so but that profile is initially there, so I'm assuming it's reached a steady state in the first place.
Okay.
Question about haplotaxis and random migration. A big source of randomness or apparent randomness cell migration may be the heterogeneity of the extracellular matrix. So isn't there some amount of redundancy between the random migration term and the haplotactic term? How do you separate those out, or how do you justify separating them out?
Well, you know, that's a good point, and you'll see later on that I actually do consider the fact that the matrix isn't some sort of homogeneous blob, but I deal with that more with the invasion model. But the idea here is that there is some sort of directed response because there is some internal gradients which are built up as a result of the cells degrading the matrix. So even if the matrix is a mess and kind of, you know, heterogeneous, if the endothelial cells are going in there and they're degrading it, they're sort of somehow creating micro gradients which they themselves respond to. So it's the kind of creation of the gradient which the endothelial cells do themselves, which is what, you know, that's what that's kind of additionally capturing. You'll see what I mean when I go to the continuum model. So here we have some numerical simulations where we have three initial clusters of endothelial cells which were located along the origin x is 0, along y is 0 to 1 there, along y is 0. And we have initially assuming that three tip clusters of endothelial cells were initiated. So this is at time one, so it's moved on. So the tumour would be here along this boundary, and we're assuming at the moment that it's just homogeneous in Y, and so therefore the gradient would just be kind of decaying in X like this, kind of like what I've drawn there. And so what I've done is switch off haplotaxis here. So this is purely a chemotactic response. So the endothelial tip cells, just as three clusters move straight across towards the tumour. So there's no spreading, there's no lateral motion, it's just directed. And there's also very little change in the structure of these clusters of cells. However, when you add haptotaxis, you get quite a different morphology for these clusters. They take on this more crescent-like shape. So that's because the endothelial cells are degrading the tissue and creating a gradient, and they're effectively creating gradients both laterally and in front of them. So instead of just getting, you know, a pull towards the tumour, they also get a pull towards each other. So this kind of gives you a sort of lateral spread. So if you imagine you were a tip cell in that population, you were to trace it out over time, you can imagine that it would move out and there's a chance that it's kind of going to spread and you'll get some sort of contact with your neighbours.
The representation of it, is there in your model right here, is there a can you like point to how big a cell is in reference to the
yeah, well, so no, I can't, not at this point, but I'm going to show you in a minute where we go discrete, where so this is, that's one of the issues here, was that, you know, that could, you could argue that somehow that could produce a vascular network if you were to somehow follow over time those continuum densities and say, well, but of course you can't really see the structure. And what's really important is the structure, especially if you want to then consider flow through that structure and the stuff that Stephen McDougall spoke about before. But I want to just show how this evolved. So this was the initial continuum model. And now we're going to take it to this hybrid model, where instead of the cells being a continuous density, they're now discrete. So we now consider individual tip cells. And the tip cells still respond to all those continuous chemicals and still produce fibronectin and still bind TAF and produce matrix degrading enzyme. But now, instead of it being a continuous density, they're effectively really invariable. That NIJ is a 1 or a 0, so if the cell's there, it does it, and if it isn't there, there's no consumption or production. And the movement probabilities are driven by gradients in the androgenic factor and the fibronectin. So the movement probabilities are driven by effectively chemotaxis and haptotaxis. And you can sort of look at the precise structure. And one of the things I'll highlight here is if we imagine there was no chemotaxis and no haptotaxis, so chi and rho are all zero everywhere, then what this equation, these collapse to, is P0 is 1 minus 4kd over h squared. K and h are related to your space and time steps. And P1 to P4 are all equal. So essentially what you're saying there is without any chemical influence from chemotaxis or from haptotaxis, the cells should move randomly. That's more or less what this says. But of course, if there is a chemical attractant which is at a higher concentration in front of the cell, then this is going to start to bias these probabilities for the cell to move towards it. But because it's a probability, it's stochastic, so even if there's a high probability the cell will move forward, there's still a chance that that won't be chosen. Okay, so it adds a bit of variability in there. So, now we're dealing with discrete endothelial cells, we can track their path and see, so those endothelial cells, are because they're the tip cells, they're going to play this game of following the leader. There's initially a whole load of cells that are coming out of that parent vessel, and they're following that tip cell and essentially creating this contiguous initial vessel, which will mature over time. So after that occurs, at some point it's seen that proliferation starts to happen, and it's from what I've read, what's generally understood, it doesn't occur at the tip, but it occurs behind it. And the proliferation then, if you're behind that vessel, because this vessel's starting to mature, you can imagine that the only really thing that can happen there is that it'll push the vessel further forward again. So in some sense here, proliferation results in a further vessel lengthening, as opposed to branching. But proliferation isn't branching, it's vessel lengthening. So a branch is in fact where the...
Why can't you express that in the continuum case?
Why can't you express?
Yeah, the proliferation in the same way that you just described it, pushing forward. And why can't the PDEs also express that?
Because you'd be assuming that the whole density is... Do you mean just the tip cells? So you're assuming the tip cells are proliferating then?
Well,
I mean, there would be a way to do it. What you'd have to do is separate into two terms. You'd have tip cells and, you know, a vessel, or the vessel which is generated. And you would say that the vessel which is generated somehow proliferates or gets further extension. but you could see that you'll get, you'd have to have very sharp boundaries on that, or else you'll get proliferation both laterally and in the vertical.
Oh, wait.
So, of course, because we're dealing with these tip cells, as I've seen, then we can monitor them if they collide with another vessel, and you can have a probability of them connecting and forming a loop. But also we can sort of say, well, that tip cell is going to take on a branching morphology. So, you know, instead of it having some kind of shape like this, it takes on some kind of shape like this. And then the cells behind are kind of driven through it in some sense. So you get kind of change in the morphology of the tip cell. Obviously, I don't actually do that. What I see is at the tip, instead of it being, you know, like this, we now place two cells on there. So when a branch occurs, you effectively put two tip cells. That's what I see. And then the whole process that obeys the same rules.
Sorry, I missed the point. So when you have, how do you put the two cells there?
So, you know, the tip cells are all that's there initially. So if you imagine that this would be, so this is the tip cell. So this here is really the path the tip cell created. And doesn't really exist in a kind of physical sense in the
model. So do you have cells there or not after the tip in your model?
Do I have a cell here?
You have a cell at tip.
What
yes. About right afterwards?
What, behind it, you mean?
Behind it.
Yeah, so, but they don't do anything at this stage. They're just laid down. And, you know, in some sense, they're a boundary to the other cells.
So you don't have physical cells following the tip?
No.
Okay.
The tip cell is the leader, and these guys just are sort of, you know, in some sense, laid down. As soon as that he moves on, we place a cell behind it.
Okay.
You see what I mean? So your tip follows the path, makes the path.
Got that. But did I misunderstand you earlier that cells in the maturing vessel behind are proliferating and pushing the whole thing forward?
Yeah. So that's exactly right. So this tip cell. Has a movement probability, and those movements, this tip cell can go here, and go here, and can go here.
Right.
So as when proliferation occurs, what happens is effectively is this tip cell is pushed here, or it's pushed here, or it's pushed here. So in some sense, what you do is you add an additional block.
But the proliferation is occurring further down.
So yeah, so essentially what happens is you get extension of the vessel, an extra extension on top of the possible migration. So proliferation gives you an extra extension.
Well, later you'll explain to me why you can't put that in a PPP.
Okay. So anyway, with those processes in place, we then decided to look at two different gradients produced by the tumour. So the assumption being that here we would have a tumour which is essentially this whole boundary here, so therefore produces like a linear gradient. So if you imagine it was an extra big tumour. Whereas here, we have a kind of smaller tumour which is kind of focused here, and therefore produces a more radial gradient. And then one of the assumptions was that with regards to branching, to try and tie that to what we see in the experimental results, there was no evidence for this, but this was just an assumption, was that because branching seems to occur, rapidly increase as you approach the tumour, we correlated branching probability with angiogenic factor. Now, you know, that doesn't have to be the case, but this is what we assume. Okay? So this shows the kind of branching probabilities as a function of angiogenic factor. All of that changed with the work from Stephen, where we have branching related to shear stresses, and the flow through the vasculature. So what you see here is a kind of experimental result, which is probably the best sort of linear tumour that we could find, but it was just a much bigger tumour source. And you can clearly see, first of all, it's not that sparse at the beginning, it's pretty dense. But you see there's a clear transition somehow between less branching and very much more branched. And so that's why they call that the kind of brush border effect, because there is a kind of clear transition. And so then this is the equivalent simulation for the model. And essentially we just started with four tip endothelial cells, which then migrated in response to those chemical gradients. And the reason you're getting that kind of lateral migration is due to the degradation of the matrix and the sort of build-up of this lateral spread and branching and so on. We change then just that source, nothing else changed, and you get this sort of structure. So the point really here is that you get connection much earlier on. And, you know, so the probability will increase branching, but because these guys are already on top of each other, it's kind of hard for them to branch. So that's one of the simplifications of working in two dimensions, of course, because we're assuming that these, we put this restriction to say that the vessels couldn't really be over the top of each other, whereas in three dimensions, that's not an issue. You know, they just migrate around each other.
Is that corner pocket type of, so the simulation is based on?
Yeah, so that it's really, it's not based, it's just an analogy between what you're seeing. Yeah, that is the cornea pocket.
It's cornea pocket, it's not.
Yeah. So it's a paper by Jim Brony.
So here's
just another two runs. And what I wanted to do here was, I always got the question from people was, well, these pictures look the same, but that's not enough, is it? You need to do more than looking the same. You want to quantify them somehow. So what I did was I took these two networks. One of the standard measures for vasculature in the literature is the vessel length distribution. So what we then did was we calculated the vessel length distribution for these two networks and compared them. And so what I mean by vessel length distribution, well, essentially what you do is you measure the length of the vessel until a branch point. And so that's the end of the length of that vessel. Then you start counting the length, you start measuring the length of the vessel again. And every branch point, you end that. So you end up with a kind of distribution of lengths, vessel lengths for the whole network. And so what we found was, so this is both of you, so the small source is the circular one, and the large source is the linear. So you see that, you know, unsurprisingly, there's a very large amount of very small vessels, or vessel lengths, and very few kind of larger length vessels. And that kind of distribution is exactly what's seen in the, you know, when you look at these things in the literature. What's kind of interesting here is that for the larger source, you get much, you get more longer vessels.
In your pictures with the circular source and the linear source of the two networks that were formed, what does your tap concentration look like? Like, are you tracking that as well?
Yeah, so after it's formed or during, or before?
During.
Yeah, so
I mean more after, I mean when you have the mass of.
So there's, it's basically a slight perturbation off of what that. Let me go back to. Because we actually put this one. So that's what it looks like. That's really the TAF, sort of the TAF concentration related to the probabilities. You know, so here it's really a smooth radial sort of surface produced by a small tumor here, whereas here it's really a kind of decaying pseudo kind of exponential type shape.
So basically you're saying
something
that
like that.
The uptake really doesn't...
It doesn't have that big an impact because it's really... in, you know, those tip cells aren't doing that much locally. You know,
and you're sourcing it continuously with some...
No, we're not sourcing it. That's what I'm saying. I'm assuming that it's all... Been, so that was in some sense one of the criticisms that Howard gave, but it doesn't seem to be. So we're choosing the probability purely, so the rules for choosing the branching probabilities are identical in these. The only difference is the gradient. So you're saying that if you had some...
You're trying to find, well, kind of probability distribution.
All right, no, we didn't pursue that.
But I'm just wondering, because now is there a kind of simple function that translates the concentration of taps to the branching?
No, we just say that if it's you know, less than 0.3, it's 0. If it's above 0.8, it's 1. You know, it's just kind of like you just sample the concentration. You know, there's no real evidence for this apart from just what we see. But it was just, you know, to try and correlate it with what we see.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how the way you think it will affect the distribution.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. So it does, clearly it's going to have an impact, isn't it? Because, you know, if we said, well, you know, your branching probability is 1 if you're 0.3 and above, then you're going to branch really densely as soon as you basically appear. So we just kind of chose those more based on what kind of looked like, you know, counting the number of branches that we've seen and saying, well, roughly you're going to have, you know, a higher probability when you get to that point. You'll be more or less 100% when you get to that point. But what changes all this anyways when we incorporated the flow? Because then shear stress has a big impact on the branching as opposed to being kind of directly, you know, related to this idea.
Just to confirm in that slide. So your probability ranges there,
yeah,
forming that funny nonlinear function, that's based on measurements of the lengths before a branch.
No.
Or not. So
no,
it's
no,
arbitrary.
It's like a visual thing. There's no quantification for that.
And is there what would the sensitivity of your pictures look like when you change those regions?
Well, that's what I was just saying to him. You can imagine if you were to say the branching probability was 1 the minute the vessels appeared,
yeah,
then you would get densely branched networks from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. But how non-fictional would that be?
I guess that's the question here. You know, without doing, well, so, you know, once we did this sort of quantification, in some sense that gave us a kind of indication that maybe those probabilities we'd chosen were kind of okay. Because if we'd chosen it the other way, all your branches would be up here. There would be no long
yeah.
branches.
So this is a kind of a validation.
It is, sort of, you're right.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah. You're a better shape than you thought you were.
Okay, so this is one of the interesting things that we did was, you know, we looked at the effect of chemotaxis on the number of vessels that were coming. So what you're seeing here is a bit of a mess, but I'll kind of show you a clearer version of it. But essentially, as you migrate faster in response to the androgenic factor, the vessels all have a better chance to form or not. Okay? Because of course if you shoot straight to the tumour, you've not had any time to branch. So what's interesting is there's a switch. So if we look at it, just like look at each of those curves in isolation, taking a sample from each. So this is for a specific time, which is roughly equivalent to something like 12 days or something. And so this shows chi, so as I'm increasing the chemotaxis factor, so higher means obviously a stronger response. And this is the average number of vessels that occur over a few runs. And what you see is there's a kind of peak in the maximum number of vessels that can be produced, which is somewhere around between 0.3 and 0.35. And what's interesting is that that's sort of the value which is kind of in the literature that's sort of been found. So in some sense, you know, nature found the best chemotactic response. Because if it had been any faster, in this model, this is obviously based on the model now, if it had been any faster, then they don't have enough time to branch. So under all the assumptions that we have, this sort of comes out. But again, you could argue, well, that only comes out because you kind of put the answer in the first place. But, you know, but it wouldn't have surprised me if there had been no change or you didn't see anything until it was really high. You know, so it was kind of just a nice little result.
Is it the same for 2D and 3D?
I've not tried that in 3D.
Because as you said before, in 3D they're piling up on top of each other.
Exactly. Yep. Well, in 2D they're piling up. But they can't pile up. In 3D they can move more freely.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, you're right. So we did this in 3D. And show you a little movie of that. And of course, you know, this is the idealized situation you'd be seeing with one vessel and, you know, some tumor down here. But of course, really, the tumor's probably inside some complicated tissue domain, and there could be many neighboring vessels in which it's responding to. It doesn't just have to be one. So, if you look at this, what you'll see is there was five, but that guy turned in on himself for some bizarre reason. So then, you know, the branching, I can measure there as well the number of connections. And what's interesting is the number of connections obviously is reduced in three dimensions because there's more space. Okay, so.
So this picture is like one of the, so through the piece, this, like if you feed the run, you are going to get, this is like on average what you get, or?
Yeah, so you know, that's one of the kind of nice things I think about this model is that, you know, every time you run the simulation, if you have a different initial seed, a different random seed, then you'll get a slightly different structure. But ultimately, because all the gradients and all the continuum variables respond in the same way to the where the endothelial cells are, you'll get slightly different structures. I mean, so you'll get the same general trend, you know, they'll all branch round about here, they'll eventually connect up more or less round here. You know, you're going to get that same kind of look, but it's not going to be identical every time. Okay, so I'd now like to go into the kind of second half, really, of the talk, and, you know, to some extent the newer stuff. And this is really talking about human invasion, because, of course, as I clearly showed at the beginning, angiogenesis is that crucial link between the tumour kind of getting stuck at some small size and invading, taking over. And so here we have a cancer cell and some of the kind of the assumptions that I'm going to build into the model. So we're assuming, again, that these cancer cells produce some matrix-degrading enzyme, which results in matrix degradation. I'm going to assume as well that these cells respond to the gradients within the tissue, whether pre-existing or ones they create, or both. I'm now going to implement some oxygen, so some nutrient source, which would be produced by angiogenesis, or if the tissue's already somehow got some pre-existing vasculature there, I'll include that. And all of this, it's known, are kind of modulated by cell-to-cell and cell-to-matrix interactions. So, you know, how the cells adhere to each other can affect all of these responses. So here we have the mathematical model. And now I'm just going to assume, and again, proliferation is only going to occur at the discrete, because I'm going to switch very quickly to the discrete model. So we have random migration and haplotactic migration. So that's the tumour cells now, we're not talking about endothelial cells. This is the matrix, which is going to be degraded by the matrix degrading enzyme, which is going to be produced by the tumour cells and has some sort of natural decay, diffused very slightly. And here's the one which is the new equation in some sense, is the oxygen term. And the crucial term here is this one, in the sense that it's an oversimplification. Because what I'm saying there is that the matrix is somehow producing the oxygen. Okay, now I could put clearly here, I could take that angiogenic network that we've just grown and say all those tip cells are producing the oxygen. But what I didn't want to do was kind of in some sense introduce some form of heterogeneity which was a result of the angiogenic network. What I wanted to do is see how these things grow in isolation. So in the moment that's an oversimplification. And it's something, obviously, which will change when we combine the two models.
You're using C here to represent general concentration of TAF and
no,
oxygen?
No, C is just oxygen, so there's no TAF in this model.
Well, I
yeah.
Same effect of TAF.
No, because what you'll see in the discrete models, the cells will die and things like that. You know. So that's the continuum model. And you can look at sort of, you know, so in the moment, in the initial equation there, I had normal diffusion, but of course we can have non-linear diffusion. And so what up here I've said that essentially the tumour cells will diffuse in response to gradients of the matrix degrading enzyme, as well as haplotactically responding to it. So you get a much sharper boundary here. So the red is the tumour and the green is the matrix. And the kind of dashed line there, dashed dot line, is in fact the matrix degrading enzyme. But what's interesting is that the cells which are at the leading edge here get the strongest haplotactic response and therefore invade the furthest into the tissue. So, you know, this very simple idea could be a mechanism of why you have metastasis. I mean, obviously it's a very simple idea, but essentially if you're on the boundary, you're getting the biggest response to anything that's surrounding you. So therefore you have the biggest chance of maybe migrating out and invading further. But obviously there's lots of simplifications. So we can do this all in 2D, and essentially you see the same thing. If we take a slice through that, so this is just the tumour cells now, then you see you'll have one bump at the origin where the tumour cells started, then another bump further out, and you can sort of see that. So it's not very interesting. But as the point someone over there made earlier, the tissue isn't really a homogeneous mass. It's actually kind of pretty messy in there. But it is not also a kind of nice bumpy matrix like this, which allows for numerical simulations to run nicely, but there's a start. So here we have a kind of pseudo heterogeneous matrix. And so if we run the same invasion model through that, it starts off very similar, but as, of course, there's a pre-existing gradients, you start to get sort of deformation of that nice circular invading tumour, and eventually what happens is you get sort of hot spots of tumor cell density occurring purely as a result of the hemostatic response to the pre-existing tissue that was there and through the process of degradation and so on. So when we showed these to our colleagues in the surgery department up at Nine Wells Hospital in Dundee, they couldn't believe that you could get something that looks like a tumour from such a simple model. And we all proceeded to write a paper together. Sadly, it didn't result in them giving us any experimental data to validate it in any way. But at least you know, they got interested, so it was a first step. So I can show a small movie of that, which is kind of interesting. So that, you know, that's just sort of spreading and invading over time. And you see kind of, you know, a hot spot of density occurring here. And in some sense, this is a bit of a cheat, because you're kind of putting the answer in the sense that you're saying the matrix is already bumpy. And you can almost look at that initial matrix and say, well, the way the gradients are, a lot of cells will build up here. You can sort of see that.
And the other aspect, perhaps, is that while the absolutely everything you said sounds reasonable, in addition to that, tumors typically aren't growing. So let's say we could magically remove the matrix,
yeah,
you could leave the parenchymal cell, then there's discontinuities there as well. It doesn't matter, unless maybe you're in the middle of a cartilage or something where it's very homogeneous, but other than if it was in a muscle or a visceral organ, there would be interstices and lumps and because of the tissue in which tumor resides.
Sure. And I guess there's other cells in there too, which are sort of
connected tissue cells and so forth. Yeah.
So
is this spread just a function of random motion outwards and not towards an oxygen gradient or
so in that initial continuum model there actually was no oxygen. I just showed the full system equation because I didn't want to show them twice. So it's not a diffusion there, it was diffusion plus haptotaxis. So really the thing that's creating the kind of weird densities is haptotaxis. So because their cells are migrating towards those higher densities in the tissue, which they then subsequently degrade. Okay, so then we went to a discrete, you know, this hybrid model again. So now the cells are discrete, and as before the equations, but now of course N is a Boolean variable, the tumour cells are there or not. But I didn't just want to go and have discrete cells that just, you know, behaved all the same. Because we know that the tumor population is in fact heterogeneous. Oh, this shows a nice schematic. This is more for the biologist when I talk to them, to show if we imagine we had a three-dimensional breast tumor, say, and you take it out, if we could take a very thin slice through it and put it on a grid, that's kind of what we're doing in these simulations, is taking a very thin slice through a three-dimensional tumor. And then we're monitoring how these cells migrate and interact with the surrounding tissue and proliferate and mutate. So, as I was saying, we didn't want to have the tumour cells all being the same, so I wanted to implement some more tumour cell specific processes to try and make the thing more realistic. And so one of them I was interested in was the P53 gene, and the other crucial one was cell adhesion. So I wanted to incorporate into these cells the ability to have differential adhesion to each other, the ability to, say, proliferate at different rates, consume different oxygen amounts, you know, just as a result of, say, their metabolism, you know, how much energy they were using. And, of course, some of them could be better migrators. So I wanted to implement all of these things. And I'm sure I don't need to argue why that's important, but these kind of three little pictures here show clearly to me why adhesion is important. So these are tumor spheroids. This guy's grown in a standard kind of gel environment. So there's growth factors and stuff in there, but there's no matrix components as such. But then here we add some matrix components like fibronectin. And what happens, these are on the same scale incidentally, what happens, instead of it staying as this compact ball, all the cells which are on the boundary migrate out a little. They still all touch each other, because they don't want to lose contact. But then if we add this other component, tenascin, which is another matrix enzyme, then what happens is the cells literally fly apart. And so, you know, if we could see the larger field, the cell spread away out here. You know, so this is for the same length scale, the same time scale. And you can see clearly how much more invasive or how far these guys have got in comparison to that. So it's clear that adhesion, cell-to-cell adhesion, cell-to-matrix adhesion, plays an important role in the invasion of these guys. Okay, so crudely, what I did, I thought about doing was incorporate different phenotypes. So we all know that the heterogeneity is at the kind of at the genetic level, but ultimately that expresses itself in the cell behavior, so at the phenotype scale. So the standard approach normally with tumors is to grade them in types 1 to 4, or you know, less aggressive to more aggressive. So I thought, let's start with 4 phenotypes, which go from what I call the least aggressive type 1, where we have a proliferation age of 18 hours. We have a kind of known oxygen consumption rate, which you can get from these tumor spheroids. Then we have pre-production, that's on baseline for that, and a cell adhesion value of 3. I'll explain what that is in a minute. Then we go to type 4, which is the most aggressive, so it takes half the time to proliferate. And I'm assuming, because it's such a good migrator, this guy, he's also going to consume more oxygen. Now, that might be a wrong assumption, but this is what I'm assuming, and you'll see later that potentially that's wrong. It produces 4 times the amount of matrix-degrading enzyme, and it has 0 cell-cell adhesion. So you can see that these other two are somewhere in between. So the coloration is going to be the color of the cells you'll see in the simulation. So what do I mean by adhesion? Well, the kind of jigsaw idea is always quite a nice analogy. So if you're a cell of type 1, then in some sense you want to adhere, or you'll try to adhere to your 3 surrounding neighbors, as many neighbors as you can. You want to be very adhesive. Whereas if you're a type 4, you can be a lone cell that doesn't need any other cells to adhere to, that doesn't care. You can migrate freely from other cells. And then the other two are somewhere in between. So I implemented all those processes within for each cell. And the way that it sort of comes in is via what I'll call the cell life cycle flowchart. And so I'm going to look at 2 schemes. This is the first one, which is the linear mutation scheme. And it's linear because after the cell goes through this whole process, it becomes like a type 1 cell. When it mutates, there's a small probability via proliferation that it will mutate to type 2. And then if you're a type 2, there's a small probability you'll mutate to type 3 and so on. But there's no probability of mutating backwards. There's no backwards mutation. You only mutate a more aggressive phenotype always. And that's why I call that kind of linear mutation scheme, because you know you're always going to progress to this more aggressive phenotype. So essentially, each cell in this simulation is going to check, is there enough oxygen out there for me to survive in? Now, I know that this is a simplification because, of course, there's cells can exploit the glycolytic pathway as well, but at the moment we're just looking at the oxygen. So then it gets a bit older. Has it reached the proliferation age? If that's a yes, then it looks to see, is there sufficient space for it to proliferate? If there is, it goes through mitosis. Does the mitosis result in a mutation? If there's not sufficient space, the cell will become quiescent and it'll just sit there ready to proliferate when space becomes available. And then kind of looks to see if there's enough oxygen. And if at any point the oxygen falls below some critical threshold, then sort of set the cell over to cell death pathway. Okay, so let's look at some simulations first of all, I should probably explain the initial conditions. That's a good point. So we're going to assume initially all the cells start off at the same age, which we can change if we need to. So I'm going to assume that these cells are initially not mutated in P53. So essentially this is a switch to P53 idea, and as soon as a cell becomes P53 mutated, then it passes that on to all cells that are its progeny. But if it doesn't go through this P53 mutation, then it'll die, because I'm assuming the cell's behaving strangely. So if it doesn't manage to mutate that early on, then it gets killed off. I'm going to assume that there's no matrix-degrading enzyme initially, because the tumor cells will eventually produce that. There's initially a constant initial oxygen concentration throughout the matrix. It's homogeneous. And all cells are kind of set to this type 1 initially. So the time scale simulation, each time unit's 18 hours. The domain is a centimeter squared. And I'm going to look at 3 initial matrix distributions.
Are you counting on having 2 copies of P53 here, or is there just one net effect of either all can have total P53 or no P53?
Yeah, it's just a switch. It's an all or nothing. You know, basically, you have it mutated or you don't. And if you don't, so initially they're all not mutated.
Right.
And then via proliferation, you have a chance. And if you don't manage it via those first few proliferations, those first few mitoses, then you'll die.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, as soon as it happens, every subsequent cell has it. So it's only kind of interesting at the very, very, very beginning, because everything then after that is mutated there already. Okay, so this is kind of like the technique, in some sense, the hybrid technique. So you solve all those continuum variables. You then assign the movement probabilities for each cell in the population. But before they can move, you then look at all the individual properties, like, are you adhering to another cell? Can you move? Are you degrading the matrix? Are you proliferating? Are you mutating? You know, are you quiescent or whatever? You look at all these assumptions, and then the cells will move or proliferate depending on what those rules turn out.
What's your condition for quiescence, and what's your condition for cell death?
So cell death occurs as a result of the oxygen being below something like 0.1% of the initial oxygen concentration for something like two generations. So if the oxygen level's low for like 36 hours, very low, then assume that the cell will die.
What about
quiescence? Quiescence is a result of, as I sort of said that, you know, space constraints. So a cell wants to proliferate, but it's trapped by other neighbors and it can't. So it becomes quiescent. Okay? So here we have the, in some sense this also shows the initial conditions. So this, I don't know why it's going on. So we have a very low, well, zero matrix degrading enzyme. The matrix shouldn't be zero there. I'll see, maybe it'll come in a minute. The oxygen is high everywhere, and we have a small cluster of 25, I think, type 1 cells. So let's look at this. So initially they're all orange. Then there's some P53 death in the center. But very quickly, you mutate to that blue, most aggressive phenotype. Okay? Now, what's interesting is when you mutate to that blue, aggressive phenotype, look at the oxygen distribution. There's this big sweep of oxygen being more or less zero from, it kind of comes from the outside in. Do you see there's still some sort of red in the middle? You'll see what I mean. Just watch the oxygen. See, it's still sort of reddish here. And it's because those guys are consuming so much oxygen, which is one of the model assumptions, you get this kind of wave of death that comes from the boundary inwards. Yeah. So, you know, that might not be realistic, it might be built into the assumptions in the model. But the kind of crucial point I want you to take from this is that in this kind of homogeneous environment, you get more or less a kind of circular tumour. And also, you get more or less a population which is split into two cells, dead and aggressive. That's it.
What's the size scale?
It's a centimeter.
It's 1 centimeter?
Square. Each one of these is a centimeter square. Okay.
And so that diffusive boundary then is you're saying the
so here?
Yeah, the line of death, you're saying between dead and alive. How much is alive at the
time? What percentage of the population is that mean?
Well, is it all this diffusion?
I mean, the oxygen's still diffusing in here, you know, at the standard rate, but because those cells are consuming it so quickly.
Yeah, it's not the centimeters, so I'm saying you can get a few hundred microns at the edge.
Yeah, you're probably right.
You know, I think there's something that probably needs to be incorporated into a model like that, or at least considered. As the tumor invades, it is invading through an existing tissue that is highly vascularized, or at least, vascularized to a certain degree, and there are other cells in there as well, and so forth and so on. So depending on how invasive that tumor is, it's communicating with vessels that are already in the tissue, and those vessels contain a fair amount of oxygen. So the periphery, if it's a very highly invasive tumor, is taking advantage of, you want to use the word, co-opting vessels that are in the tissue.
Sure. You know, in some sense, that's kind of built into an assumption of the model, which is that the matrix is producing the oxygen. But because the tumor is somehow degrading the tissue and filling that space, those vessels or those oxygen-producing areas are getting consumed or degraded by the tumor. You know, what happens to those vessels that are pre-existing when a tumor grows and invades? does it still leave them switched on, or does it shut them down? I mean, once those vessels become internal. So the assumption here would be it somehow shuts them down. So it, you know, kind of cuts its own throat, so to speak. But those guys on the boundary don't care because they're in the oxygen rich zones. But you're right.
I was just going to say, you know, for some of the spheroid stuff, which we don't have vascularization, just have these cells that are in some of the models, in the spheroids, right? There's one thing you've ever seen in these movies of the spheroids where cells in these different regions, they move a lot. They crawl all over each other, and they sort of, so there's a lot of sort of back and forth between what's an inner cell and what's an outer cell.
Sure.
So, yeah, so I don't know if that sort of mixes things up
a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could be.
My understanding is about cell division is that, okay, you have some distribution of cell age and mitosis, but by and large that distribution isn't really perturbable by external influence, so that the cell's either proliferating or it's out of cycle. Yet you ascribe somewhat of an age distribution that's condition dependent. That if the this other theory is true, would that return?
So what you mean like they shouldn't have different mitosis rates, is that kind of
well, good? There, you can imagine the difference on account of the average between being quiescent and cycling, but you can't, as far as I know, you can't distort without taking it to out of cycle status with cell cycle time.
Okay, well, you know, at the end of the day, we're all dealing with models, and it could be, maybe that's an oversimplification, I need to try and incorporate it in a different way. But the crucial point in some sense here is that the cells which kind of exploit the environment the most dominate. So whether the proliferation is upregulated as a result of some other process or my assumptions is kind of irrelevant to some extent, as long as somehow there's a cell which is a better proliferator than other parts of the population. But anyway, let me get through this because I'm already late and we're all itching for a coffee. So here we have the same situation but in this more bumpy matrix that we had before. And so what you get is virtually the same sort of distribution. But of course, what's interesting now is you get this fingering morphology. So part of the reason for that is obviously due to the fact that this tissue has now got big gradients built into it, and those cells are kind of exploiting those gradients that are on the boundary. But still,
so
it was somewhat surprising to see. Sorry?
So the cells, they are trying to go up gradient towards
the
hot spots in your last picture, right?
Yeah.
So why don't the fingers actually go into those big, but they don't correspond?
No, so because it's not directly correlated, but it's more or less. So the idea, if you look here, red, remember, is lower, white is the highest. So there's a kind of path here, which is, you know, sort of a high concentration where you might want to move. But as they move in, they degrade it. So there's a sort of feedback going on. There's a kind of outside signal, but there's also the fact that they are also degrading the tissue, so they're creating a kind of forward movement signal. But anyway, so you could sort of argue that you're putting the answer in. So let's look at something where we have a completely random matrix instead. So, you know, there's no pre-pattern here, and let's see what happens. So everything else is the same, and the only thing I'm changing is the matrix in these three simulations. And so initially it starts off kind of circular, and then you get this kind of wave of death, and those most aggressive cells can emit fingers even more. Okay? So those fingers are now a result of interactions with the matrix and creating their own microgradients and responding to those. So it's almost like a kind of feedback between the cells degrading the tissue, getting into a slightly more oxygen-rich zone, proliferating, and then migrating further again. So this is not pre-patterned, it somehow evolves. Okay? But you still get that same morphology. Now, one of the problems maybe with this is that cells don't always mutate to a more aggressive phenotype. Sometimes mutations result in a cell, say, dying, or a cell mutating to something less aggressive. It doesn't always result in a good effect for the cell. So this linear idea is maybe not so logical. So what I then wanted to do was look at a random mutation as opposed to a linear mutation.
But I would argue that if it mutates the other way, it's going to just drop out of the system. And
that's
so that the impact is going to be from the forward mutations.
Yeah, you're right. So you're going to see that in a minute.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I completely agree. So what then did was it take the exact opposite extreme. So, you know, coming from linear becoming more aggressive, I said, okay, let's just, for example, take 100 phenotypes. You know, it could have been 1,000, it could have been 50, but I just thought, let's take 100. And of those 100 phenotypes, now I'm going to pre-assign like a parameter for proliferation, for adhesion, for oxygen consumption, and so on, within the ranges of those four aggressive ones. So, you know, the minimum will be is type 1, and the maximum will be is type 4 for each of those parameters. But you choose it randomly. I don't know what happens at the beginning, you just choose them randomly. So, you know, you've no idea what that initial distribution is. After the simulation, I go back and look at who wins. So now, everything else is the same, but when you have a mutation, there's a small chance of you jumping to a completely different phenotype. So your mutation results in you going from something completely different, which is obviously not true either. You know, you're probably going to mutate a little bit, change a little bit, but this is the opposite extreme of that linear. So let's see what happens. So the same simulation in the homogeneous tissue, and now coloration here is related to adhesion only, and not obviously type, because there's 100 types, if you like. And so what you see is, very quickly, the cells which have zero cell adhesion dominate. Okay? And you get a kind of more or less circular tumour. There's a slight boundary effect going on once it gets close to the edge because of the oxygen, you get kind of squaring off, so ignore that. But essentially, you get a more or less circular growth here. And so what's interesting now, we had a linear mutation sequence with four phenotypes. We've got 100. I can now look at the simulation and say which phenotypes were in the population as time evolved and who dominated and who didn't. So what we have here, this graph here shows you time along this axis, the phenotype number along this axis, and the numbers of those cells which had that phenotype. And what you see, so initially, you know, that all of them are kind of in there. But even though there's random mutations, so you're jumping randomly to any one of those 100 phenotypes, there's still about 6 or 7 which completely dominate. Every one of those that dominates has zero cell adhesion. And every one of those has got a very high proliferation rate, you know, as a result of the randomness. And what's interesting, though, is that most of those don't have a high oxygen consumption rate. Because why would you select something that effectively could kill you? So in some sense, it kind of results in, just as you're saying, you end up with a very aggressive phenotype that wins the day, but it's not going to select for something which is going to hurt it. So if we now do the same simulation, but in this random tissue, okay? So again, it grows very similarly, but, you know, more or less quite quickly you start to get this fingering occurring. And now the interesting question is, what is the phenotypes that are in that population? And so is, perhaps surprisingly or perhaps unsurprisingly, that more or less there's a single dominant phenotype that wins the day. Now, when I initially saw that, I didn't think it was correct, and I tried running several other simulations to see, you know, if this was just a one-off. But it's consistently seen that there's much fewer phenotypes that dominate in what I would call now a harsher environment. So if you imagine in this homogeneous matrix, it's easy for the cells to migrate and respond, it's nice. But in this random matrix, they're getting signals which say move forward, move back. You know, it's much more difficult for them to sort of decide where they're going, so they get trapped, they die. So effectively creates some sort of selective pressure, which focuses the population, and you get the single most aggressive phenotype more or less dominating the population. So when I compare that phenotype to all the 100 other ones that are there, it's the single highest proliferator. It's got zero cell adhesion. It's kind of a lower oxygen consumption. It's one of the best migrators in the population. So there's some kind of natural selection that occurs. Now, I must admit, I was really surprised by this, because there's random probability that every time that guy proliferates, he'll jump to somebody else. But when he jumps to somebody else, that guy dies instantly, or just doesn't survive. So it's only when a proliferation results in selection of the same guy that it wins out.
Or doesn't die, but has learned to live right where it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, because of the way the mutations are implemented, it's always jumping around. Okay, so harshness of the environment is one of the things that seem to be sort of, you know, implicated here. So
is this, is the location of the map,
changes because the initial 100 is random.
Okay.
So let me give you one last simulation before we go. Oh no, let me show this first of all. So if you run it, just this is the point you've just kind of made in some sense. If I change the initial seed, you'll get a slightly different morphology every time, but you can see more or less they're all sort of the same sort of structure. And every one of those has that same, there's one or two kind of dominant phenotypes, and they're all, they always have the, they're always the most aggressive in the whole population. And what I wanted to do was at this stage, in some sense, show some experimental evidence for this. So this is from a paper by Panic Chieti et al., which is from Cancer Cell. And here we have a normal tumor spheroid. And now if you induce hypoxia, what you get is this very kind of fingered looking spheroid. So, you know, I'm getting fingering as a result of interactions with the matrix and so on. So this gave me the idea, well, let's look at, you know, really starving the tumor and see what happens. But, you know, because it's a simulation, because it's in silico, we can play with it a bit more. So what I'm going to now do is show you a simulation where initially I have a high oxygen concentration, and then I'm going to drop it to, it's almost, you know, killing the cells for a period of time. And then I'm going to push it back up to high concentration, and then I'm going to drop it again. And we'll see how it impacts both the morphology of the tumor and the mutations within the tumor. Okay? So what you're going to see, if you watch the oxygen, you'll see it will go high and low. So initially, what you see is a more or less, circular mass, and then you switch the oxygen to low, you get a very fingered morphology. You'll see it switch back on again. Now, and you get a massive proliferation, switch off again, and you get these tiny little fingers coming out. So that clearly shows that, okay, the matrix was one factor that's playing a role here, but if you can just treat oxygen, so our hypoxia, the mechanism which is killing the cells is as a mechanism for selection, so it's enhancing the selective pressure of the environment. And so you're getting these fingering structures as a result of the hypoxia, but also we can look at what's the phenotypes exactly of those structures. So now this is within the same simulation. So that question that you just asked is kind of relevant now. So initially what happens, you can hardly see it, but up until about T is 50, there is kind of more or less all this, the phenotypes are in the population. I then switch the oxygen to almost zero there. And what happens is there's three phenotypes which dominate. And again, those are the most aggressive phenotypes in the population. I then switch the oxygen back on here, and now everybody comes back in again. Because remember, you've got these random jumps that are mutations. But what's nice is when you switch the oxygen back off, the same aggressive phenotypes come back to dominate. So in some sense, for me, that was like a kind of validation that those phenotypes are, in fact, the ones that should be selected. Because, you know, out of everybody's there now, you know, any one of these guys has a chance of making it through, but they don't. It's only those three. Okay, so let's conclude. So, in some sense, I want to conclude more on the invasion stuff, because Stephen McDougall really kind of did all the conclusions for the embryogenesis. So it's clear that both cell adhesion, cell matrix and adhesion are important. But the implication is here because, in some sense, your cells that always make it to the boundary are the guys that have already lost cell-to-cell adhesion. Cell-matrix interactions seem to be really crucial in terms of dominating and deciding what the tumor morphology is. What you saw from those was the kind of random mutation sequence, just as you kind of highlighted, is very similar to the linear because you end up with the most aggressive phenotype. But what's the kind of, you know, in some sense, maybe contentious or if you may agree or not, that somehow the harshness, so we'll call it harshness of the microenvironment, but something which is a force which will hurt the cells, so push them into death, is somehow aids in the selection of what's called the invasive phenotype, because you get this sort of fingering. And that experiment I showed you, in the way they describe it is they say that those spheroids that grow with these more fingered morphologies, they call that an invasive phenotype, and they say it's smaller, in fact, it grows smaller, but it's much more aggressive. So in some sense, it kind of agrees with what we're seeing here. So it clearly, for me, important, I mean, all the biologists, I'm sure, would completely agree that this clearly emphasizes the importance of the microenvironment. And there's a whole story missing in there of other microenvironmental factors, but it's a step towards those. So further development would be, we're trying to now parameterize, because a lot of the parameters for this are taken from, you know, disparate parts of the literature, for specific cell lines. So let's get everything, all those parameters for a single cell line and see what happens, as opposed to just taking it from different parts of the literature. I want to include the angiogenesis within that. I want to look at 3D implementation, and I want to maybe look at modeling some of those intracellular processes like proliferation and so on a bit more realistically. So I'll just conclude with showing you a little 3D. So this shows you a 3D tumour growing, and that slices through, which you saw kind of in some sense an experimental picture at the beginning. And finally, perhaps more interestingly, we have grown later at later stages. So this is slices through a three-dimensional tumour. It becomes very hard to visualise it because it's just this big mass of cells. But what you see is you'll see areas where it's clearly branched and areas where it's just kind of like cells that look like they're separated. Now clearly there's matrix in between all of that, but I'm not really showing you that. But the point is you can still get similar structures occurring and you get similar phenotypic behaviour in three dimensions. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thanks for your time.